You are listening to a sermon by Brent Siemens, recorded on Sunday, February 22, 2015, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, good morning. I always enjoy coming here. So, this morning I'll be sharing from Genesis 9, 8-17, which was just read for us. It's the story of the covenant God makes with Noah and his family after the flood. But as we will see, it's not just a covenant with Noah and his family. It's also a covenant with every living creature. The birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the field. So I'd like to do two things this morning. First, I'd like to look at this covenant that God makes with every living thing. And second, I'd like to explore what the rest of the Bible more broadly says about the value and treatment of these other living creatures with whom God has covenanted. So to begin, let me quote Richard Dawkins' view of the flood story. He writes, "The legend of the animals going into the ark two by two is charming, but the moral of the story is quite appalling. God took a dim view of humans, so he, with the exception of one family, drowned the lot of them, including children, and also for good measure, the rest of the presumably blameless animals as well." Is Dawkins right? Is the flood story really quite appalling? Does God really have a dim view of humanity? I would like to say no. I don't think so. In fact, it seems to me that Dawkins has it all wrong. Here's why. First of all, the reason for the flood in Genesis is not because God has a dim view of humanity or his creation. Rather, it's because the earth was corrupt and filled with violence. Violence is the one sin that's marked God's creation at this time. People were ruining the earth. There's another ancient Near Eastern flood story known as the Epic of Gilgamesh, where the gods send a flood to wipe out humanity because humans are multiplying too much and they're making too much noise. The gods are having trouble sleeping. So the gods seek to wipe them out, eradicate all of us. This, I suggest, is a dim view of humanity. But I think Genesis, and the author of Genesis, is wanting to counteract such notions as suggested in the Gilgamesh epic. I think Genesis is wanting to say that the flood never happened because God was angry, nor because humanity was multiplying too much, nor because humanity was making too much noise and God couldn't get his precious sleep. Rather, it says that God was grieved in his heart over the depth of evil and violence that had marked his creation. And so the flood is portrayed as God reverting creation back to its pre-creation state, where the earth was formless and void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. The waters again engulf all of creation. And so the flood did not happen because God has a dim view of humanity, but because humanity and all of creation had totally corrupted its way on the earth. The flood is an undoing of God's creation. Secondly, the flood is not only an undoing of God's creation, it's also a remaking of creation. As the Spirit of God hovered over the waters in Genesis 1 at creation, so God sends a wind over the flood waters in Genesis 8. In Hebrew, it's the same word used for spirit in Genesis 1, ruach, with the wind in Genesis 8 at the flood, ruach. At both creation and the flood, God sends forth his spirit, his wind, his breath, over the watery chaos in order to bring forth new life. Bruce Waltke makes an interesting observation. He notes how the remaking of creation in the flood story echoes the 7 days of creation in Genesis 1. The sky appears, then the land, then the birds, then the animals, and lastly people, Noah and his family. And so besides judgment on a violent, evil society, the flood story is also a story of hope and new creation. Thirdly, God does something remarkable in the flood story. I think this is quite exciting. As I suggested, the reason for the flood is because of human wickedness. Genesis 6:5 says, "Every thought of the human heart was evil continually." But after the flood, notice nothing changes regarding the human situation. Genesis 8:9, which is after all of this happens, again affirms that man's heart is evil from its youth. So what has changed? What is different after the flood from before the flood? Certainly not humanity, not even Noah and his descendants, for humanity continues to be evil and corrupt. But something has changed with God. What has changed is God's dealing with humanity. Never again will he send a flood. In spite of the waywardness of every living creature, God in his mercy still decides to covenant with all of us forever. And fourthly, the emphasis in the story is not on where the flood begins with the flood, but where it ends up, namely, God's covenant with every living creature. As Old Testament theologian Walter Moberly puts it, the text's overall emphasis remains Yahweh's resolution to sustain life on earth in the future. This is very different from what Dawkins thinks. So let's look at Genesis 9 and this covenant that God makes to sustain all of life on earth in the future. Five times in this passage, God's covenant is described. In verse 12, God says to Noah, "The covenant is between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all generations." Verse 13, God says, "Between me and the earth." Verse 15, "Between me and you and every living creature of all flesh." Verse 16, "Between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." And verse 17, God says the covenant is between me and all flesh that is on the earth. The message of this passage is striking. Five times God says that he has covenanted with every living creature, with all flesh, human and non-human, even with the earth, for all generations. The rainbow becomes a sign of this covenant, which God makes between himself and all of creation, to ensure its preservation and flourishing. As one commentator writes, "Stretched between heaven and earth, the rainbow is a bond of peace between both. And spanning the horizon, it points to the all-embracing universality of the divine mercy. Every living thing gets included in this covenant." Now, what does the Bible say more broadly about the treatment of these other living creatures with whom God has covenanted? Do chickens, for example, matter? Is the habitat of whales important? Is there an ethic to even how we are to prepare our food? I'd like to look briefly at the major sections of the Bible, just exploring what these teach us about the value and treatment of other living creatures. To begin in Genesis 1, it's actually the fish of the sea and the birds of the air that are the first things in creation to receive God's blessing. Not only did God bless them, but he commanded them to be fruitful and multiply. Six times in Genesis 1, even before humanity arrives on the scene, God saw that his creation was good, and his animal creation was good. It suggests that animals have intrinsic value apart from human purposes, apart from what they do for us. Cows and cougars, salmon and salamanders, armadillos and alpacas are good. They have intrinsic value in themselves given by God, and they're commanded to flourish. In Genesis 1:28, God then proceeds to tell humanity to also be fruitful, also multiply, fill the earth. The text seems to assume that it's possible for both humans and the non-human creation to flourish together. Both humans and animals are commanded by God to be fruitful and multiply. Yet God also says to humanity, and subdue the earth, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the beasts of the field. This language of subdue and rule can be quite strong, and it's led some environmentalists to blame Christians for the ecological crisis that we're facing. According to the Bible, they say, humans are commanded by God to ravage and plunder the earth and the animal populace. Yet I think this is a fundamental misunderstanding of God's command to humanity in Genesis 1. Indeed, God has commanded humans to rule over other living creatures. But this is a delegated rule from God, which is to reflect God's own ultimate rule in this world. So what is God's rule like? Psalm 72, for example, describes it as characterized by justice, compassion, deliverance from violence, rescuing the poor, and helping the needy. This was the type of rule that was to mark Israel's king. And this is the type of rule that is to mark humanity's rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the beasts of the field. Humans are appointed by God to have dominion over other creatures, but not in a self-serving manner. Rather, our dominion is to be in a self-giving, responsible, compassionate manner, reflective of God's own character and ultimate lordship. The Old Testament law also expounds on this human responsibility towards other living creatures. And I think it's important to note when reading Old Testament law that it's not exhaustive. And this may seem surprising when reading books like Leviticus or Deuteronomy, but I think it provides examples of righteous living. This is what righteousness looks like, this sort of thing. One interesting law is in Deuteronomy 22, 6 to 7, which states that if someone comes across a mother bird and her eggs or her young, they may take the eggs or the young, but the Hebrew is emphatic that the mother must be let free. The heart of this law, I think, shows a concern for the conservation of other living creatures. There's even a promise attached to this command, which says that it may go well with you and that you may live long. That's for just looking after a hen. But I think the heart of the law is that this is how we are to treat animals in general. One of the reasons for the fourth commandment, to honor the Sabbath, is specifically so that your ox and your donkey may have rest. There is a concern here in the Sabbath law for one's beasts of burden. The laws concerning the sabbatical year, where the land was to rest every 7 years, shows a concern, or reports that the fields, those years, were to benefit particularly the poor and the wild animals. Sorry. It shows a concern for wild animals and their coexistence with agricultural lands. A fascinating law regarding the treatment of animals is found in Exodus 23:19. It says, "You shall not boil a goat in its mother's milk." Jews understand this law to be a prohibition against eating a mixture of milk and meat together. It's not kosher, they say. But Old Testament ethicist John Barton suggests that the command to forbid boiling a young goat in its mother's milk suggests that there needs to be a respect for the animal, even in the preparation of food. To boil a young goat in its mother's milk is simply cruel to the mother and to the young goat. This law suggests that there needs to be a respect for the animal, extending even into the kitchen. And I think this is part of the reason why the Old Testament forbids eating meat with blood in it. Blood in the Old Testament represents life, and all of life is sacred, even the life of animals. God's concern for animals is visible not only in the law, but also in the wisdom literature. The Psalms show how God himself provides for all living creatures. Psalm 104, which was read for us this morning, says that God provides drink for the wild donkeys, grass for the livestock, habitation for the birds, and rocky crags for the mountain goats and badgers. Even the young lion's roar is portrayed as a prayer to God for his food. In describing the psalm, Richard Bauckham comments, "There is a pervasive sense of the world as God's gift to all living creatures. Yahweh is a God who delights in his handiwork and in caring for everything he has made." In the Psalms, animals even contribute to their maker's praise. Psalm 148 includes an exhortation to the great sea creatures, beasts of the field, livestock, creeping things, and flying birds to praise the Lord. Richard Bauckham again writes, "The psalmist invites us into a world that is wholly oriented to the glory of God." An important verse for establishing a biblical ethic towards animals is found in Proverbs 12:10. It says, "Whoever is righteous has regard for the life of his beast, but the mercy of the wicked is cruel." The Hebrew word for life is nephesh, which means life, person, soul. This verse illustrates that the righteous person cares for the soul, the life, the entire well-being and wholeness of the creature. On the contrary, the wicked are cruel to their animals, even in so-called acts of mercy. So compassion towards the entire well-being of an animal is portrayed as a characteristic of a righteous person in the book of Proverbs. The prophets also have important contributions for developing an ethic towards animals. For example, Hosea comments that because of Israel's unfaithfulness, the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field and the birds of the heavens, and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Hosea shows a link between human sin and animal suffering, while these other passages show a connection between righteous living and the flourishing of the animal population. And finally, in the Gospels, when Jesus is wanting to illustrate to his disciples that the Father keeps us in both life and in death, he points to the sparrows. "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows." God keeps even the sparrows when they fall. Surely then God will keep us when our time comes to pass away. So to return to Dawkins again, is the moral of the flood story really appalling? Does God really have a dim view of humanity and the rest of creation? Not at all. God has such a high view of every living creature that he covenants with all of us forever, in spite of our waywardness. And he shows us how to treat other living creatures with respect, compassion, and self-giving love, as he himself holds every one of these animals in his hand, whether in life or in death. He keeps them even when they fall.